But I guess, you know, freedom is a simple word. But, you know, when we really start to encounter it, it's profoundly moving. And what I mean by freedom here is that inner freedom. For Mandela to do those sorts of things, he obviously had transcended or become free from his own history, his own fears, his angers, all that, and could kind of hold a space of real freedom, which is to say, yeah, we want things to change on the outside. Don't kid ourselves. If they can't change on the inside, they're not going to change on the outside. And obviously, the one other element in the whole story is that reaching across divides between oppressors and oppressed. There's no coincidence, and I'm quite sure at some deep energetic level, those gestures of Mandela were absolutely vital for what ensued in the next few years, the Truth and Reconciliation process, which if you talk to anybody who went through it, was an amazing. I consider it, maybe what's going on in Canada would be my second candidate, the highest gestures of civilization I've seen on the planet in the last three decades. You know, bringing together the oppressors and the oppressed to sit and talk, tell the truth, forgive each other, so we can move on. So these gestures to show that, you know, we feel trapped, but there are ways out of the trap. There are keys to this cell, but the keys are not the ones we're normally looking for.
Welcome back to Integral Voices, convened and produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. I'm Bailey Murphy with Meridian University Center for Transformative Learning, and I'm glad to be introducing today's conversation entitled Freedom is a Simple Word, Allowing Another to Be a Legitimate Other, featuring Peter Tsang and Aftab Omar, with an introduction from Melissa Schwartz. This conversation was recorded live with a virtual audience. Integral Voices is a video and audio podcast found on all podcast platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts, as well as YouTube. To stay updated on upcoming episodes and to explore the archive, please visit meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. And now, on to our conversation on freedom is a simple word, allowing another to be a legitimate other.
By way of honoring and welcoming you, Peter, I will read a short passage from Martin Buber that's been quite important to Peter. I'm going to take the liberty to substitute the neutral pronoun of they and them instead of the he and him that's in here, which is responsive to the times that we're in. Also, I'll be inviting you to share in the chat what was evoked for you. The free person is one who wills without arbitrary self-will. They believe in destiny and believe that it stands in need of them, yet does not know where it's to be found. But they know that they must go out with their whole being. The matter will not turn out according to their decision, but what is to come will only come when they decide on what they are able to will. They must sacrifice their puny, unfree will, which is controlled by things and instinct, to their grand will, which quits defined for destined being. Then they intervene no more. They intervene no more, but at the same time, they do not let things merely happen. They listen to what is emerging from themselves, to the course of being in the world. Not in order to be supported by it, but in order to bring it to reality as it desires.
So welcome again, Peter. Many people will recognize this passage because it's included in the chapter on the grand will in the book Presence. Could we begin with your reflections on what is the it in the last sentence? Not in order to be supported by it, but in order to bring it to reality as it desires. What is the it?
Well, my first thought is that language always enables and constrains, right? In a kind of a technical sense, language is a set of symbols we use to kind of point at something. In the context of the passage, it's his attempt to talk about destiny. There's another part, different passage, but close to that one, where he distinguishes fate from destiny. And I think, as in so many times, you know, when we're trying to deal with something that's very subtle, we set up a contrast. Not because it's A or B, but it's like a little bit more like a binocular vision. By having two things we can hold, we maybe see the territory a little more. And he talks about fate as keeping someone in leading strings, as the metaphor, you know, it's like kind of, it's my fate. And personally, I think today, one of the greatest problems in the world is fatalism. I believe we live in an era where there's so many levels of fatalism that it's hard for us to see. A classic example to me, particularly for most of us in the world today, is technological fatalism. This notion that there's this relentless march of technology, and it goes on and on, regardless of whether we like it or not, regardless of whether we think it's creating well-being or limiting well-being, it's basically out of our control. There's many things like that that we regard as out of our control. And to Buber, that was the essence of a culture that has succumbed to fatalism. Is more and more you feel the things that are really shaping what you care about, not just arbitrary problems, but things you really care deeply about, like climate change and species and social well-being and the health and well-being of children, things that are really deep in our kind of innate sense of human priorities, are being affected mostly adversely in ways that no one is in control of. A slight variant of fatalism is conspiracy theories. No, it's the 10 richest people in the world who are in control of everything. So that's, to me, another type of fatalism. You know, it's basically saying I have nothing to do about it. And really, no one can, because after all, those 10 richest people, they're the ones who have all the power. So conspiracy theories, to me, are kind of a subset of fatalism. So what Buber is really trying to do is kind of invite us into a deep reflection about destiny and fatalism. The word destiny, all words, you know, they're just ways of pointing at things. The word destiny can be heard often as being very much like fate. But he makes a very critical distinction there. And it's all embedded in that passage, but in several other related ones, that no, destiny really only arises in a context of choice. In a sense, it's the fundamental distinction between fatalism or fate and destiny to Buber. That fate is not a matter of choice, destiny is. So that whole image of the free person, and the, by the way, the German word is Mensch, so it's actually a gender neutral term. The free person goes out, must go out to meet her or his destiny. Doesn't sit passively and wait for it. So the it, I think the simplest answer to your question is the it is destiny. But you have to really think a little bit about what the heck does destiny mean?
I'm thinking, Peter, of the Greek word telos or telos.
Yes.
Often translated as purpose, but inadequately so, which seems to have some of the intimations that you're speaking of. Yes?
Yeah. I think it poses all the same difficulties. In other words, many scientists kind of started to reject what they called as teleological explanations as a kind of a carryover from the 18th and 19th century and 20th century science, because it was seen as very fatalistic. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, in the deeper sense of purpose, this kind of, and this raises obviously very profound ontological as well as epistemological questions. You know, is it just sitting there, your purpose? Or is it something that's kind of outside of you, but only exists in reality inside of you? So all these questions are kind of linked back to some recurring deep themes in all philosophies. What's inside, what's outside? You know, what's external to me? What do I have no control over? What's internal to me? What do I have control over? Of course, in modern Western psychology, what's internal to you, you don't have control over either, because it's all drives and instincts. So I think that it would be wonderful to me. I was obviously have an opinion here. If teleological could be resuscitated, because I've always thought it was a very important idea in Western philosophic history. Telos is not fate. It's something much bigger than fate, but it fell prey to the very same problem that Buber was trying to point to.
Peter, you're generally known for the ideas you've written about, because those ideas have become more and more influential. This is a gathering of practitioners. Some practitioners, not yet, but headed there. But also in this gathering are early and mid-career practitioners, and a few senior practitioners are also here. So I'm hoping we can draw on your decades as a practitioner. And I've been aware that the Field Book, which came fairly soon after the Fifth Discipline, relative to other of your writings, is less often cited. And so I have this very broad question, knowing that you've been turning more and more your attention over the years upstream in terms of the locus, your locus of practice. But stepping back and looking at the world now, I'm recalling the 30 years that Lester Brown, every year, he kept putting out via the World Watch Institute, the State of the World report. I'm wondering what your reflections are today on the state of the world.
Well, I think just picking up the threads that we've already started to kind of lay out, I do think it's an era where there's a lot of fatalism. You know, children are always a good window into a question like this, because up to a certain age, you know, let's say up to the age of 13, 14, 15, they're extremely direct. You know, they become socialized in our mainstream cultures to be less and less direct usually by then, because they're starting to manage perceptions and have legitimate concerns about how they're seen in their various social groups. You know, very natural developmental questions for adolescents. But in our cultural context, it tends to drift very quickly towards just managing the facade. You know, so you're really focused on how you appear to others. Whereas earlier in life, we tend to be more direct. Kids are very pessimistic about the state of the world today, not just teenagers, young children. And that pessimism has been growing for a very long time. There's been a variety of quite good studies in the last couple of years, kind of surveys of different sorts, but well designed to really reveal this sense of pessimism. I know that the one place where we do a lot of work very closely connected to the province of British Columbia. It's the only place in the world, as far as I know, I keep asking, and no one's come up with a good counterexample yet, that actually rigorously tracks the well-being of children from birth. Well, actually, it started from age 5, but now it's been extended upstream from birth. All children in the province, through a series of instruments that are administered in kindergarten and in different stages of school. And not surprisingly, probably had the largest long-term commitment to social emotional learning of any place in the world, going back again about 20 years. And the two were kind of related in terms of political priorities in the province of British Columbia. and the well-being of children in British Columbia, we have compelling, has been steadily falling. They have a variety of vulnerability indexes that all get rolled up into something called the Early Years Index and the Middle Years Index. But it's the most rigorous effort to track how are the kids doing in any place in the world. The kids are not doing well, even though there's been an unprecedented commitment to a lot of things that would have them do better, like really focusing on social emotional learning in primary and secondary education. So I think we can say with some confidence, if things are going worse for the kids in British Columbia, they're going worse for the kids everywhere. And first question for me of that is, like, do we care? It's one thing to say, well, we didn't know. Well, we didn't know because we didn't care, I would say. How important is that to us? Because again, to me, children are the most, in many ways, reliable window onto the state of your world. You might say that, you know, historically, if you look at societies that I think have been relatively healthy, you know, I know a lot about the history of China, spent a lot of time in China, and China has the benefit of looking over a 5,000 year span, and they see many golden ages, and they see many ages that weren't very golden. And like most places, usually when you have periods where societies are working pretty well, they really prioritize two things, which is the well-being of children and the legitimacy and respect for children and the space for art. So the artists and the children, you know, they're the kind of natural lenses onto how our society is doing. So I would say, you know, we have a lot of problems.
Peter, there are these lines from D.H. Lawrence, which go, not I, but the wind that blows through me. A fine wind is blowing the next direction of time. If only I could let it carry me, bear me. So there's the images in these lines, and then there are the images in the Yeats line that we hear a lot. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the ceremony of innocence, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. So if we hold these two sets of images in some creative tension, along with your emphasis on the challenge of fatalism, we have a zone of choice for personal will, and perhaps we could say system will. Mm-hmm. What do we know about system will?
Well, again, these are domains. The first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, language is not trivial. You know, system will is a phrase that's probably not going to evoke a lot. There's a lovely phrase in traditional Chinese culture which kind of points the same direction. The problems of collective karma cannot be overcome by heroic individuals. The problems of collective karma cannot be overcome by heroic individuals. So to me, that's kind of opening this same question. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to shape collective karma? Which is a much more traditional way to talk about what we are all talking about when we talk about systems, right? I mean, it's probably a traditional way that gets very deep very quickly, because it not only points at habit, you know, simplest translation of karma is habit, but collective habit as well as individual habit. And the notion that the deep habits, or in the Sanskrit you would call sanskars, have accumulated over many, many embodiments. So they're deep. You know, regardless of whether or not you take a reincarnation perspective, you can just say they're very deep. And they're deep collectively, not just individually. So I think the term system will is a good term technically, But you know, both words are problematic. First off, we hear system in a very mechanical way. We don't hear it in this kind of profoundly cultural, social way of karma. And we tend to think of will as willpower. That's why the Buber quotes and the beautiful D.H. Lawrence one is a beautiful way to kind of get at this territory of will in a very different way. Rather than something that comes from me and it's my way of exerting myself in the world, which would be the colloquial use of the will, it's something that comes through me. I have a role, but it doesn't come from me. It's a great line from the Lebanese poet, Khalil Gibran, who talks about children, says, your children do not come from you, but they do come through you. So it's a beautiful metaphor for this whole territory of, it's not that I'm in it, I have no plan in it, but if I think it's only about me, I've obviously missed something, as Lawrence is saying. So I think that system will is a nice thing, but I would not use the terminology. I would find ways to talk about what is it that we really care deeply about. Obviously, that includes me. There's no we without a me. What do I and we care deeply about? What do we care so deeply about that we would be willing to give up things that we're habituated to? That's kind of the territory that you traditionally will get into when you have these kind of conversations. But how to do all of that in a way that you're not just stuck in the individualized will. There's another lovely term from traditional Chinese philosophy called jiahua, which is almost unknown to contemporary Chinese because it was one of the many, you know, things that got pushed out of China in the colonial era. And it was the oldest term that predated and was used basically the way we would use the term education. But jiahua means teaching so as to transform. And what you're transforming are the prenatal seeds, the deepest aspects of our karmic, or I'll just say the deepest aspects of who I am, that stand between me and enlightenment. And that's education. So it's not that humans have never kind of developed some capacity to have a different orientation, but we have a lot of relearning to do and maybe a lot of letting go to get to that.
Teaching so as to transform.
Teaching so as to transform. It's an almost lost term. So many Chinese kind of recognize it, but they're not sure what it means. They certainly would never use it because it became supplanted by the term xiaoye, which is the contemporary term for education, which is a very westernized concept of schools and classes and all that kind of stuff, but not the deeper human developmental element of real education, which Xiaohua was all about.
Perhaps, Peter, we could make a turn here in terms of connecting your work with education and your awareness of culture. You're unusual in terms of the degree to which you draw from non-Western sources in this field. What are the cultural interventions, and I don't know if interventions is still a good word here, but culture does transform for worse and better, and we could say that when we get focused on cultural exchange, like education, we're moving upstream as practitioners. What do we know about cultural change as practitioners?
Well, I mean, again, it's a big word, useful for me to start by kind of bringing it down to something a little more concrete. So let's look at organization culture as a just a concrete embodiment. I think the larger cultural context is, of course, critical, because that's where so many of our deep problems arise still. You know, years ago, I had a great mentor for a long time, all of us at MIT did, named Edgar Schein, who kind of wrote some of the definitive books about organization culture. And I remember Ed teaching us years ago, he said, well, if you want to learn about the culture of organization, don't bother reading all their values and all that. That's all great, but that's just their espoused culture. Go to a meeting and pay attention. Who speaks? Who doesn't speak? What gets talked about? What gets talked about afterwards in the ladies' room or the men's room that wasn't talked about? And by the way, there's not many good conversations in men's rooms, but someplace where the men would go. That wasn't said at the meeting. So culture is, the other key point you always point, it's really the here and now of how we are showing up with each other. And the visible and the invisible, I said the spoken and the unspoken. But of course, if you're paying attention, you can get a lot of that. You can see a lot. I think this is one of the big dangers today. This is a bit of an aside, but you know, in increasing dependence on the mediated web-based communications, so much of the information, so much of the potential awareness that we need to sense what's going on in the group is really lost. But of course, it was being lost gradually because we weren't paying much attention anyhow. If you look at most traditional cultures, they never step into a meeting. They always have a ceremonial way to come together. They pay a lot of attention to the transitional spaces, you know, the entry space, the exit space. How do you convene? How do you host? How do you acknowledge your gratitude for the opportunity to be together? What are your ceremonies for opening a space? We just jump into the work. That's one of the reasons the electronic media are so dangerous, because they're basically building on this habituation that let's just get to work. So a lot of what could be a more fluid and more transparent and more visible cultural lens is lost by how we organize a meeting. So again, all this is organization culture. You want to transform organization culture, you transform what happens in a meeting. It's that simple. I mean, it's more than just that, of course, but I mean, that kind of gets you really grounded. And I would say the same has got to be true at societal level. You know, how do we show up with each other? What happens in any given conversation? How many smiles do we encounter during the course of the day? How many smiles do we give to people in the course of the day? I mean, I think the transcendent lesson I learned from Ed Schein is culture lives in the concrete particulars. It's a tricky word because we tend to abstract very quickly from a mind like culture. What's wrong with us? But, you know, how do I feel when I do this or that, or when I have this exchange? So it's the kind of particularity of culture that makes culture culture. So I think that when you look at it that way, it is very fluid. Once I start showing up differently, and others will start showing up differently, culture is very malleable, potentially. It just requires this one little tricky element, which you used at the very beginning, of awareness. It's very hard to change how I show up if I'm unaware of how I show up. So it all starts with that element of reflection, you know. Can I kind of hold the mirror up? Can we hold the mirror up for each other so that we can better understand how we are showing up now? That's the key to the potential malleability of culture.
And some people, some are practitioners, systems practitioners, but many others who are not, some people have an impact that is culture transforming. Let's take a well-known example, Nelson Mandela. What is happening there?
Oh, well, that's a tricky one. You ask these difficult questions because there's so much that taps me into. I had the good fortune to spend a lot of time in South Africa during the last 5 years of the apartheid era, and then stayed pretty closely connected in the ensuing 5 years. First off, you could say, well, what happened to Mandela and in his 30 years in prison. You know, he was an angry. I mean, I didn't know him. I didn't know people who knew him then. You know, I did get to know a lot of people who knew him well during my time there, although I never actually met him. But by all accounts, you know, he's a pretty angry activist sort of guy. And then, you know, something gradually changed in prison. And I think by the time he was released from prison, he just had this profound sense of destiny. That, and the spirit we were talking about before, I think he'd probably be one of the best embodiments I can think of. And part of it, just to illustrate, I mean, this is just a little tiny lens on what was undoubtedly a very multifaceted process, was relationships he developed while in prison. One of the wonderful stories was told to me by a close friend who was at the inauguration. So finally, in 1994, they'd had their election. It went through about a 4-year period between when Mandela came out of prison. Apartheid was officially ended in, I think it was February of 1990. De Klerk gives his famous speech. He says, all these formerly politically banned parties are now unbanned. I was in South Africa where that speech was given. It was quite an amazing moment. And then it was still another few months before Mandela was actually released, well, about a month or so. And then there was this very dicey period where they still hadn't had elections. So it was about a 4-year period. It was extremely fluid. It could have easily erupted into all kinds of violence. Tutu, Mandela, and a few people just held this kind of profound sense that the history was guiding us towards something. Anyhow, the story, though, is really simple. When they finally had the election and his inauguration, which was 4 years after he was released from prison, on the dais with him in the inauguration were his, in South African term would be warders, two white men who were his jailers. This was a very important gesture for him. And in his remarks, he talks about them. He turns and says, you know, I've invited, I can't remember their names, so-and-so and so-and-so, because they were my warders in Robben Island. We got to know each other as human beings. So something kind of cracked or eroded for Mandela. He then did something which the significance of this, I think, is impossible to judge if you weren't a South African. So they all, at the end of the whole ceremony of his inauguration, they sang the new South African national anthem, which no one had ever sung before. So they had to project the words and all that, because that was symbolically, there's a new country. We have a new anthem. When they finished that, I don't think this was premeditated. I think he just did it on the spot. He had everybody stand and sing the old South African anthem, the anthem of apartheid. They all sang together. So this kind of holding of the past and the present is the key, but this deep holding. Something clearly happened to him. And, you know, that's why starting off with the Buber quote is quite lovely. It's a way into this territory. Well, you get to a point and it's not about you, that's for sure. It's not about your history, that's for sure. You're just nothing but a vehicle. But then you can step into something to really be who you can be as a vehicle.
Peter, along with you, many of us are also touched by this story. What are we touching into right now? What's affecting us in this story?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I can just offer a few personal comments. First off, obviously for me, it has a lot of personal resonance because of so many close friends, people I know who were so much part of that whole process. But I guess, you know, freedom is a simple word, but, you know, when we really start to encounter it, it's profoundly moving. And what I mean by freedom here is that inner freedom. For Mandela to do those sorts of things, he obviously had transcended or become free from his own history, his own fears, his angers, all that, and could kind of hold a space of real freedom, which is to say, yeah, we want things to change on the outside. Don't kid ourselves. If they can't change on the inside, they're not going to change on the outside. And obviously, the one other element in the whole story is that reaching across divides between oppressors and oppressed. There's no coincidence, and I'm quite sure at some deep energetic level, those gestures of Mandela were absolutely vital for what ensued in the next few years, the Truth and Reconciliation process, which if you talk to anybody who went through it, was an amazing. I consider it, maybe what's going on in Canada would be my second candidate, the highest gestures of civilization I've seen on the planet in the last three decades. You know, bringing together the oppressors and the oppressed to sit and talk, tell the truth, forgive each other, so we can move on. So these gestures to show that, you know, we feel trapped, but there are ways out of the trap. There are keys to this cell, but the keys are not the ones we're normally looking for.
So if we take a turn here back to education, educating for the capabilities where the most leverage could be imagined. Caroline Salborn is here with us, and Caroline, you're working with your colleagues with on the inner development goals. Peter has come to some of those gatherings. What has been your experience, Caroline, over these last couple of years while the inner development goals understood as so much about inner freedom? What is that trajectory? And I'm wondering if you have a question for Peter about that work.
Oh, I feel... I just really enjoy being in the same room as you, Peter, because you make us reflect on a deeper level. Second, I think I'm really touched right now, touched by the story. And what struck me now, looking at, I think if I'm hearing you and going back to your thinking after, I think looking at what capabilities are needed in order for us to grow, it easily very much become a mental journey. And I think what you were saying, Peter, is really about the inner journey. And I think what struck me now, which I would like to stay maybe then, is how do we foster forgiveness? Because that's really what I heard you saying. You know, holding and compass the present and the past at the same time means also very much holding ourselves and both the individual and collective with our individual and collective traumas as well.
Right.
And I think this is very much about systemic change. It's also about holding that and also honoring it. Mm. And I sense that you were touched also by the story you told. And I'm curious about what are your deeper reflection right now? What is it that makes you so touched in this moment? Because I think there is deeper senses within you.
Yeah, words are not always very adequate. But I appreciate the question. Thanks. Well, I guess one of my premises for a long time, and it occasionally kind of surfaces, and it reminds me, you've been kind of assuming this for a long time. You forget, but it's pretty fundamental, is we have very little idea what it means to be a human being. I think we're living in an age that has been a long, steady erosion of this. That's why, like my comments about ceremony, and whenever you're around, I mean, I've had the good fortune to be in a lot of ceremonial sessions with Native American, particularly people, you know, Native cultures from where I live. And I'm always so struck by what, to me, the word always comes to my mind is sanity. To come together and first give thanks for being together, for the opportunity. And obviously starts with also, or includes also, being thanks for being alive and to be welcome to each other and to receive each other. Whenever I'm around people who start a meeting that way, I go, oh, this is sanity. Which then, of course, reminds me, and this is another part of why the emotions are so strong, is just how insane we are. I really believe we are an insane culture. I mean, if you think about, by almost any definition of insanity, you know, you organize yourself, give all your efforts and energy to creating things you really don't care about. And systematically find ways to turn your back on the things you really do care about. I mean, those are pretty good operational definitions of insanity. And you get really good at doing it, too. So I think that starting with this simple gesture of humility, that we really don't understand humanness much. And that, I think, a corollary with that is we don't really understand life very much. Because we're nothing more or less than an expression of life. When I say the word humanness, it's easy to evoke an individual or to evoke a bunch of us as a species. But I don't think you could understand humanness without understanding what life is. I mean, they're two sides of the same inquiry. What does it mean for something to be alive? And again, I'll use a traditional Chinese term, which one I'm sure many of you have heard, qi. In the Taoist tradition in China, you have these three kind of aspects of quote energy. I'll use the simplest English word, but it's not a good translation. Qing, qi, chao. So qing is fire energy. Vitality would be the best English word for qing. It's associated with the body from the navel down, all the appetites, the vitality, the energy. A lot of what we would call a healthy person has a lot of qing. The traditional Chinese symbol for qing is fire. Qi, the traditional Chinese symbol for qi, is no fire. It's the energy of silence. It's the energy of pure motionlessness. If you're ever around a group of people who get really quiet because something is happening, they get really, that's qi. The best English translation for qi would be life force. Qing is vitality, qi is life force. Qing qi shen, shen is spiritual energy beyond form. So these are all considered like the nuts and bolts, the most basic way of understanding what a living system, as a human, as a living system is. And we kind of can recognize them when I explain it the way I just did. Probably every one of those terms made sense to us. So it's sort of like we know this. But any one of those, I mean, I remember the teacher I had in China for a long time used to say, well, qi, you say qi, but it would take lifetimes to understand what qi is, this life force. So I think when we consider these questions seriously, we realize, you know, a certain humility. And I think it's a starting point. You know, it's a little bit like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. What's the first step, right? Yes, I am addicted. I am clueless. I have no clue what a human being is. I live in a body and I think my body is me. The first step of our expression of cluelessness. And by the way, when the body's gone, that's it. So, you know, we're lost. But you only start the journey when you say, oh, I'm lost. That to me would be a collective gesture of recognizing that. Now, trained as I am, and many of us probably here as a scientist and being deeply embedded in the modern scientific world at MIT, I think there is this possibility that out of the Western scientific arc of the last 200-300 years and these deeper understandings, some new synthesis is trying to emerge. I do think that's a possibility. And I think it's not coincidental that some of the more important teachers of those last 50 years have held that vision, including the man I had as a teacher in China, including the Dalai Lama, that something could emerge. Right now, mostly what's emerging is problem. And, you know, where the Western materialistic view is basically trying to destroy and working very hard, we all are, to destroy these deeper knowledge. But I think that statement of humility, that we really don't know what a living system is, qi is invisible to us. Probably it is invisible in every way, but it's not accessible to us until we start, you know, and this would be an image used in many, many cultural traditions, including the Chinese, open our hearts. You know, it's not coincidental that in the Taoist system, Qing is associated with the body from the navel down. Qi is centered to the third eye chakra, and it subsumes the heart. So that part of the body that knows in a different way. And then, of course, qi, shen, the spiritual energy from the third eye up. So these are old systems, which means they've been tested. They've been used a lot. They're not perfect. They're just models. Nonetheless, they can help orient us. And I think if there's anything that's really important in that wind that's blowing, we are really more and more, whether we're doing a good job of it or not, we more and more are a human presence on the planet. We recognize there are really different cultures. We have a lot to overcome in our tribalistic fear of each other, but we are working at it. And, you know, nature is giving us a little stopwatch. We don't have forever to work this out. The climate scientists kind of agree to that now, that, you know, this decade is actually quite crucial. It's not like we're going to solve climate change in a decade. Of course not. That'll take a century. It really will. But this decade, we either start to turn the ship or we don't. And I think that these are not new issues. Everything I've said is kind of very old. But what's really current is the fact that we've gotten to such a degree of imbalance with the larger natural world that the larger natural world is saying, okay, God, your time is up. You got to start to clean up your act. And that's why things like the interdevelopment goals, so many things are happening in the world like the interdevelopment goals. We're trying to clean up our act. We're starting from such a depraved state. I don't mean to say it in that way, but we have to realize just how far off we are. But, you know, that's the first step.
Peter, resonating with what you're saying, I would like to read a short poem, and it goes like this. Stand still, stand still. The trees ahead and bushes beside you are not lost. Wherever you are is called here, and you must treat it as a powerful stranger. Must ask permission to know it and be known. The forest breathes. Listen. It answers, I have made this place around you. If you leave it, you may come back again saying, here. No trees are the same to raven. No two branches are the same to wren. If what a tree or a bush does is lost on you, you are surely lost. Stand still. The forest knows where you are. You must let it find you. That's a David Wagoner poem called Lost. Peter, because I live in California, I'm hesitant to bring the word love into our conversation.
That's right. I live in Massachusetts. It's okay.
Because you know and love Humberto Maturana's work, I will bring up the word and suggest that what was touching you and us when you told the mandala story has to do with connection. And that something has happened where some great cultural transmission has been disrupted. And that this disruption of transmission, therefore the importance of indigeneity at this time, that in this disruption, a great transmission of human capability is also a casualty. And just inviting your reflections on this line. And hoping to circle back to humility.
Well, the Wagoner quote, the Wagoner poem is such a beautiful one. I mean, it's lovely to kind of just sit with some of that imagery. It kind of connects in a very direct way to my repeated reference today of ceremonial starts, you know, paying attention to the space that we're in. Because one of the things that gets me thinking about is that, in a sense, you might think of the life process or life simply as creating spaces within which beings can exist. That imagery, you know, stand still. You do not need to find your way out of here. Let the forest find you. You have a space. You know, this is where all respect starts, and it's a very suitable, appropriate connection back to Humberto's work, is to recognize that there is legitimacy to your space. Everything that lives, lives in a place. Humberto used to talk about this kind of fundamental dualism of organism and niche. Everything he understood about the evolutionary process, and it all starts with organism and niche. The two never are separate. They never don't exist together. And, you know, if you think about it just from the standpoint of all the concerns we understandably have for those who are so disadvantaged in today's world, that simple first step of knowing that I have a place and I exist because there's a space for me to exist. And that space is inviolate. Because without it, I don't exist, but I do exist. So I exist in space. There is an organism in niche. There is a space for me. And then there's me. And the two are really not separate. It's a little different kind of path into the kind of, you might say, systemic awareness territory. But it's a really good one. As I'm sure you know, after the Humberto had this wonderful definition of love, we've used it a lot. It's allowed us in all kinds of settings, including lots of times at MIT, to legitimate the use of the word, because he simply defined love as the act of allowing another to be a legitimate other. It's so simple. The act of allowing another to be a legitimate other. And it's a lifelong journey, right? To become a practitioner of that act, we spend our lives. And we can all very quickly identify all the people right now who we don't love by that definition, because we're not quite willing to allow them to be a legitimate other. But that other exists in the space for the other. So that's why the organism in niche is such a kind of profound way to think about life. Life creates a space for us to exist, and then we exist. But we can spend, in a materialistic culture, you have a natural bias towards seeing the organism, but not the niche. This is the masculine and the feminine. This is the yin and the yang. The niche is the space. The essence of feminine principle of leadership is pay attention to the space. Pay attention to the emptiness. Pay attention to everything that doesn't manifest, but without which the manifestation doesn't occur. The teacher I had in China, because I wasn't Chinese, was always giving me stuff to read. He said, well, it's a Western mind, you'll understand this better. There's a very famous text called, it's typically translated in English as The Awakening of Faith. And no one knows who wrote it. it's dated more or less the time that Buddhism was working its way into China. So it's, you know, roughly 2,000 years ago or so. And these are all very imprecise, but, and the author's unknown. It's attributed to someone called Asvaghasha typically, but everybody agrees, well, no one really knows who wrote it. But it was, it had a historic role because all religions, all spiritual cultivation traditions are cultural. They grow up in a place. There's an organism in the niche, right? So coming out of India originally, but then of course, particularly Southeast Asia and the places where Buddhism had started to take root, as it's moving further north into China and eventually Japan and ultimately, of course, Tibet, there was this effort to kind of distill the essence so that if the essence was really clear, then the manifestation could be what the context allowed. Anyhow, so it's really simple. And the awakening of faith was about 5 pages in the original Sanskrit. Now, if you can get it, you can get it online. Originally, when I had to find this, it took months to find a used copy. But now it's pretty easy. If you Google the awakening of faith, you'll find it. The original Sanskrit is about 5 pages. And it basically starts off with one mind, 2 aspects of mind. Now, translations are always tricky because back to our first comment about words. Mind is not mind in the Western sense at all. Mind in this sense is the totality of everything, literally everything. Because the 2 manifestations of mind are the infinite and the manifest, or the 2 consequences of mind, the infinite and the manifest. Inseparable. The book is called The Awakening of Faith because the faith it's trying to awaken is that enlightenment is possible. And enlightenment is possible because we exist in this space of the infinite and the manifest, inseparable. The Sanskrit term is the Tathagata Garbha. And by the way, the word Garbha, the best translation for it is womb. So that's the space Umberto tried to articulate for us Westerners. He knew all that very well. He called his organization the Matristika Institute. Matristika in Spanish, it's very clear, it comes from the word madre, the womb.
I'm thinking also, Peter, about Teilhard de Chardin's phrase, awakening our faith in the future.
Yeah.
And that the importance of our faith in the future in a time of fatalism.
Right.
Also thinking, I want to be sure to mention Edgar's 2 recent books, not so recent, but not enough attention, perhaps because of the topic. One of them is called Humble Inquiry. That's a few years ago. And then a book he wrote with his son called Humble Leadership. Also, Peter, while you were speaking about Umberto, I thought of a word from my native language, Urdu, and the word is lehaz. And maybe 3 decades ago, my mother and I were looking for a word in English and couldn't find one that quite worked. There were words close, but not quite. And so we translated lehaz to mean the commitment to sustain the significance of the other's being.
Mm.
The commitment to sustain the significance of the other's being. So, consistent with lehaz, Peter, noticing the time, and with lehaz for your next commitment, we will say goodbye to you, unless you would like to make some closing comments.
No, it's been fun. Thank you all. No, I really appreciate it. It's nice to see you again, Avtub. And I have a little appreciation for the work you all are doing together. I really do appreciate that.
Thanks for joining us. Integral Voices is produced by the Center for Transformative Learning at Meridian University. All episodes are available at meridianuniversity.edu/integralvoices. For more information about Meridian, including upcoming public courses, other podcasts, and information sessions, visit meridianuniversity.edu. See you next time.